It's 11:17, so I'm going to go ahead and start. My last panelist isn't here yet, but I just talked to her this morning, so I know she plans to be here. And she was last on the program anyway, so maybe she just decided that she had all this extra time. Okay. Glad to have you all here. I think I'll go ahead with my introduction of the topic, and then after that I'll introduce my panelists and give you just a brief sentence or two about what they'll be talking about. My interest in the topic of Mormon women and personal agency began in my late 20s when I realized finally for the first 6 years of my marriage I'd abdicated mine. I was a journalism graduate and thought I wanted a full-time career in my field, but because of pressure I felt from my husband and the church, I primarily stayed home with our children, and my life as a married Mormon woman felt like a life that someone else had chosen for me and not the life that I really wanted. And yet, I felt helpless and powerless to make the necessary changes. As always happens when we believe that we lack agency in our lives, and when we behave as though someone other than ourselves is in charge of our lives, I became a really terrific martyr. I had a lot of hidden and not so hidden anger and resentment toward my husband and the church, which finally erupted into health problems, anxiety attacks, and I was so unhappy that I ended up seeking professional help. After years of reading and talking with other LDS women, I realized that mine was a problem shared by many. The feeling that in the face of male authority figures, the church, our parents, even the neighbors, that we were not really free. Free certainly to choose whether or not we'd smoke a cigarette or tell a lie, but maybe not so free to choose whether or not we'd work or stay home, have two children or 10, drop out of college and take a job as a secretary so our husband could finish his degree, stay in or graduate or get an advanced degree. It wasn't until this professional counselor told me the obvious truth that I had the freedom to do whatever I wanted that a light bulb finally went off in my head. And because I'm a professional writer, it was only natural that one day I'd write a book about the subject. Before I go any further, I always feel it's necessary to state the obvious, that of course every choice that we make has consequences, some good and some bad, and that's part of what makes using our agency so difficult and part of why it's so easy for us to be willing to allow others to make choices for us so we don't have to take responsibility for those sometimes painful consequences, or so we think. Also, I want to make it clear, I don't believe that the free agency issue is, of course, confined to Mormon women who feel, quote, forced to stay home. I learned that there are an equal number of women out there in the workforce who are resentful, angry, and martyred because they feel that they are being forced to work or forced into anything else that they don't want to do. I decided that for my part on the panel, I would outline some of the reasons I believe that Mormon women, and some of these apply to any women regardless of their religion, but why Mormon women are prone to give away their free agency. One is that when we're children, you know, everyone is always telling us what to do, and so where do we make the transition as adults into all of a sudden saying, I'm an adult now, I get to decide what I'll do. I think the tendency is to still look to some authority figure to make decisions for us. another reason is because we have endowed men with a power, in many cases, that they neither deserve nor desire. Particularly so, I think, in our Mormon patriarchal society. That doesn't mean that men are the bad guys or the boogeymen, but, you know, all the general authorities are male, and so here we are, you know, we're married to a Mormon priesthood-holding male, and maybe we get sort of confused, like, not that we think he's Ezra Taft Benson or something, but, you know, he's a male authority figure, and we think that maybe they have better advice or better information than we do about the course that we should take in our life. Another reason is because, you know, according to what studies have shown that women have a tendency or desire to please and to keep peace. And those are wonderful qualities, except for when they mean conforming and complying in ways that aren't personally fulfilling. We obviously don't want to compromise any of our values in our anxiety to please and keep peace. Somewhere there's a fine line between keeping peace and you know, valuable compromise as an adult in this society, getting walked over. This is a particular Mormon one, or any religion, you know, a woman in any strong religion, is that sometimes we really do forget that righteousness is a choice. And instead of viewing those counsels and commandments that come over the pulpit as divine guidelines, we see them as edicts over which we have no control. But no one is ordering or can force us to live the gospel. Sometimes I think we have a tough time as women using our agency because we don't think that much of ourselves. We don't, in some cases, have that great of self-esteem. So we, you know, if maybe we want to say, this is important to me, but if you don't feel like you're very important, it's going to be awfully hard to do what you think is necessary to do, and you'll give in to whoever it is that you think is more important and more valuable than you are. The other one that, you know, at risk of offending women, is maybe we're kind of lazy. I think that even as we're working our fingers to the bone in many other ways, you know, using your free agency to make meaningful choices is often extremely difficult. I often think about how when I was writing the book, for example, you know, I would just long to go and fold a good load of laundry. You know, it would have been so much easier than all of the writing and the research that were involved in making the choice to write this book. And that doesn't mean that everyone should quit folding laundry to write a book. I don't mean that, but I just mean that sometimes we busy ourselves with lots of things and say we're really busy, but you know, maybe we're not busy doing the things that would really be meaningful to us, because they're hard. Getting that graduate degree or going back to school or whatever it is that maybe you really want to do is hard. And here's my lagging panelist. No, you can't. You'll...
You and who?
The highway patrol.
Oh, she in the highway patrol. I should say, this is the woman that I have on the panel that's the example of one who has never had a problem with free agency. And I felt like it was important to have one woman on the panel that had just done whatever she wanted in life. And this is proof.
I talked him out of the ticket.
Okay. And finally, I feel like that, well, entire books have been written. I particularly was interested in that book by Colette Dowling, The Cinderella Complex, which talks about how women, her premise is that women inherently have been taught and to have a need and a desire to be taken care of and to be dependent on others and to allow others to make our decisions so we can escape the difficulties of life. And so I think that's another reason. So... you know, in conclusion, for my part, you know, when all is said and done, and maybe we've seen ourselves, yeah, that's why I did it. That's why I gave away my free agency, you know. To me, all that really matters is that we move beyond blaming, you know, was my husband's fault, oh, it was my church's fault, it was society's fault, that we move beyond blaming and work constructively toward change and start using our agency in personally meaningful ways. Okay, I'd like to then now introduce my panelists. This is my sister. We've debated over whether we should admit it or not, because nepotism. But I'm proud of her, and I can't resist. So she, Ginger, has her bachelor's and her master's in humanities, both from BYU. She's currently adjunct faculty at Utah Valley Community College, teaching in humanities, writing, and literature. She's her ward's choir director and the mother of two. And I asked Ginger to... I should say that all three of these women are in my book. They're case studies in my book, live and in person. And I wanted Ginger to talk about how when we attempt to control others, we end up being the loser in the game, and that our attempts at control actually cause us to lose a part of our free agency. And yet the need to control others, I think, is something that each of us, male and female, probably all struggle with to some degree or another. So that's Ginger. And then I'll have Kim Sondrup speak next. Kim got her BSN at the University of Utah and is currently a critical care nurse at LDS Hospital. She is a widow and the mother of four. Before I go on, I should say that Nancy Lyon canceled out on me about a week or two ago, and Linda is taking her place. Kim is a woman who married young and, like many LDS women, felt somewhat less than free within her marriage, then was widowed at a young age with few job skills and four children to support. And I used her in my Freedom is a State of Mind chapter as an example of someone who now probably should feel very trapped by her life and that she lacks agency, and yet her journey has been such that she says that she feels more free now inside than she did before she was widowed, which is not to say that life is a piece of cake now. And if I've said anything wrong in that introduction, Kim, you can change it. And then Linda Mariotti is a graduate of the University of Utah. She's a teacher and administrator in the Granite School District, frequent lecturer at educational workshops and seminars throughout the state. She is married and the mother of two daughters. And I felt like, as I said, that she was important to the panel because she represents all of the Mormon women, and there are many, who frankly have never struggled with the issue of free agency in the church. I don't think that Linda has ever abdicated her agency to the church, a male authority figure, her husband, or anyone else. No one has ever been able to stop her from doing anything she thought was important. And yet, Linda is not selfish. She is a dear friend. She's very kind, giving. This is not a me person. She has a wonderful marriage and has always been active in the church, holding leadership positions, and has always worked full time. So we'll go ahead and start with Ginger.
Well, I'm afraid that my credentials are a little bit dubious to discuss this, since as Gail's sister, that probably doesn't give me very many credentials. Actually, the reason that she asked me to discuss this topic about women who try to control others is because I've had a hard time, because I've tried to control other people, and it was kind of a long journey for me to come to the conclusion that that's actually what I was doing. And so I would like to just tell you a little bit about my story and how I sort of worked through and came to some realizations that might be illuminating to somebody else as well. During our courtship, my fiancé, Jed, was always attentive and sensitive to my needs. He was model. He wanted what I wanted, and he loved to be with me. But once we got married, it was difficult for him to keep up such a performance. Not to say that he was false to start with, but when we were living in a one-room apartment and going to school together, it was really hard for him to be attentive and sensitive to me 24 hours a day, which, of course, is what I wanted. the attention soon stopped, and I found that Jed no longer wanted to be with me all the time, and he became very defensive of his own needs. He wanted to pursue many interests and talents, as he had done before we were married, and I couldn't understand very well why he didn't want to be with me anymore. It was different, and I didn't see why, and I was very hurt, and I felt very insecure at that time. I tried all my tricks to lure him back, and shamefully, probably most of them were female, traditional female tricks to lure him back. But Jed's a pretty perceptive guy, and everything to him looked like a manipulation. I was just trying to manipulate him, trying to control him. And his worst fear in life was to be controlled by anyone, much less his wife. The more I pleaded with him, the longer he would stay away. The more I cried that he was neglecting me, the more hardened he looked. Our situation became progressively worse, and while we've always had a natural affection for one another, this was now being dominated by the battle for control. I reacted by working harder. I both went to school and worked. I tried to maintain my church positions and be a good visiting teacher and all of that. And I felt like I was doing all of the right things. Jed reacted instead by moving farther away from me, spending more time away. He started criticizing Mormonism and behaving with nonchalance towards what I had assumed were common values. Because I felt betrayed and hurt, I tried to build up walls around my emotions, and I tried not to care about what he said or what he did. or at least I tried to pretend like I didn't care. But I'm a terrible liar, and I could never pull that off. And Jed could always see to him that was just another way of controlling him. When I turned cold, I was more unhappy, and didn't help us at all. I was miserable, partly because I felt that my life wasn't as it was supposed to be. I had always assumed this was Jed's fault. I was doing the right things. He was doing the wrong things. I felt like he'd committed to me in the temple to do certain things, and he wasn't coming through. He wasn't going to sacrament meeting with me. He wasn't doing the things that we were supposed to be doing as a family. But I never thought that these things could be my fault. During these early years of our marriage, I had continued a close relationship with a former roommate, Ruth. And we had been roommates, and even after we married, we did a lot of things together as a threesome, she and Jed and I did. And then, during the greatest crisis with Jed, Ruth started fading out of my life. I can't remember what it was about it, but she didn't want anything to do with me at that time. And I felt like not only was my husband leaving me, but my best friend was leaving me. And the floor sort of dropped out, and I was in kind of a crisis time. I didn't know what I had done to deserve such betrayal. But then I began to see a little bit of a pattern, and I had to ask myself, when I saw the same thing happening with my friend and my husband, what was I doing here? Why was Ruth's independence so painful to me? Why was Jed's independence so painful to me? Had I done this before? I started to recall all the times that I had tried to control other friends. They were supposed to call me, and they didn't. I was hurt when they found a new friend. Jed and Ruth were the first ones to really defy my rule outright. And the painful part was that they both rejected me at the same time. A year or two later, Ruth came back for the summer. And she was married now and had established, we had established a new kind of relationship. We never discussed, it's interesting to this day, we've never discussed that period of time in our lives. That's what happened. We simply took time away, and we were different then when we came back together. And I was very careful not to demand things of her and not to expect that she would do the things that I wanted to do. And then we really started to enjoy each other. And during that time, we talked a lot about my difficulties with Jed. I was amazed with her leniency with her husband. He could go out, stay out until 9 o'clock and never call. She trusted him. They had an implicit trust. She didn't try to control him, and things were working out all right. She advised me to be a little more independent, to do more things by myself. I did a lot of thinking that summer, and I started to realize that I couldn't control Jed no matter how hard I tried. No matter how right I might be. He just wouldn't allow it. I practiced being independent. I went to a movie all alone one night. It's a normal activity for a lot of people. It was a strange one for me. I was so proud of myself. and I realized that being alone was okay, and I started to let Jed go. Letting go seemed very dangerous to me. I fully expected that my marriage would fail as a result. I prepared myself for the divorce. I thought that if I didn't control him, he would behave in ways that were completely unacceptable to me. Maybe he would have an affair. Maybe he would become a drug addict. He had had a history of behavior that I found unacceptable. I was sure he could return to those and leave me. I had seen these things happen to other women. But I knew that I still must maintain clear standards for my life. I would not live with a man who was unfaithful to me. I would not have alcohol or drugs in my home. These were my lines, and I feared that he would cross them, and I would have to take responsibility for my life and leave. Until I confronted these possibilities, I could not allow Jed his agency. The cold reality is that when we relinquish control of another person, they may still do the thing that we dread. But of course, even if we try to control them, they may still do the thing that we dread. and of course, we'll be more miserable in the process. Regardless of my fears, I could see that life could not continue as it was going. We would grow to hate each other, or I would be torn apart from my anxieties. I turned over the family money to him. He'd traditionally been irresponsible, I thought. All the time I was working and going to school, he was just going to school. And I thought that he threw around money. Amazingly, when I tried to stop trying to take control and let him do it, he was pretty responsible. It took a while, but it got better as it went. It occurred to me that maybe he was throwing around money just to show me that he wouldn't be controlled by me. With the birth of our first child, I began to see why Jed wanted more freedom. I loved our son Miles, but I also wanted more freedom. Time spent alone held new charms for me. Over the 8 years of our marriage, Jed and I have come a long way. We're still married. We openly care about each other, and we don't play too many manipulative games. I try hard, and sometimes it's very hard to do, to state my needs to him clearly without trying to control him. There's a fine line there for me. Jed is successful in his job. I feared that he would never hold the job. He manages money well. We do that together. And he's a wonderful lover and a father to our two boys. But our marriage is not what I imagined it would be when we married at 20. Jed doesn't go to church very much anymore. And he spends a lot of time away from home pursuing work and his personal interests. I find it interesting that I very much feared this at one time. These were my fears, that this would happen. I just knew that my life would fall apart if Jed didn't do church like my father did. And I knew that I would be lonely and rejected if Jed wasn't around in the evenings to hold my hand and to love me. But while the literal fears came true, they are not the demons I once imagined them to be. Because I no longer try to control what Jed is, I consider his spiritual wanderings to be strictly his business. I would be very distressed if he were to try to persuade me to alter my views regarding God and my place in his plan. And I know from years of trying to do it that Jed feels distressed when I try to persuade him to agree with my views. People occasionally ask me why Jed doesn't go to church. They're so careful not to offend. And I tell them I can't really explain his religious views to them. But I do assure them that my feelings are not hurt, that he has chosen a different way than I. I consider it his privilege. I do not consider it his privilege, however, to cross certain value lines of mine and then to remain a part of my life. Just as it is not my privilege to cross his value lines, this would be much easier if he could define some for me. we have discussed together what is okay in our relationship and what is not, and we both understand that if we cross these lines, we will damage our relationship. Therefore, I try hard to give Jed the freedom to pursue some of his interests, which is very important to him, even at cost to my own interests at times. And he is respectful of my wishes, for example, to keep Sunday as a different day, even if he doesn't care, from the rest of the week. And that it's okay if he goes fishing on Sunday, but he can't take the boys on Sunday. So we've worked out a little bit of an arrangement where we simply know what the lines are rather than trying to force each other to do it our way. It took a while to realize that by trying to control Jed, I was making myself miserable. I tried hard to give him my agency. I wanted him to make my life happy and right. But unlike some men who are glad to take their wife's agency, Jed didn't want it. It was no fun trying to keep both of us happy. It was hard enough for him to keep himself happy. It was a relief to finally assume responsibility for my own happiness. I'm very grateful to Jed for insisting on agency for himself and refusing to take mine. I'm a much happier person as a result, although I still live with no guarantees for my life. But who does? My husband could still choose to leave me. He still may or may not go to church, and he may live outside my value system. He may cross the lines in which he may or I may cross those value lines, which would force us to terminate our relationship. But we each have that choice, and we're fully aware of what that is. With our relationship, the harder I tried to control, the further apart we drifted. The freedom to exercise individual agency was the medicine that we used to heal the rift. If an individual is willing to assume responsibility of taking control of her own life and no one else's, then she will be a happier person. If she does not, she will remain in bondage to whomever or whatever she gives her agency. It is sad to see people who, while trying to relieve their burdens and by giving their agency away, only increase those burdens. By attempting to extend my sphere of control beyond its natural balance boundary, I relinquished my own agency. By attending to my own agency and no one else's, I was left invigorated and had enough energy to take care of myself and also to contribute to my family's well-being in healthy ways.
I really do appreciate this opportunity to come and speak. I'm rather flattered that Gail thought that I could contribute a little bit here to what I hope is going to be maybe a little bit of a greater understanding and enlightenment to my views on how I have experienced my own free agency. I was married for 10 wonderful years, and when I think of the experiences that I had during that time, I can't help but smile and feel like one of the lucky people to have been able to share 10 years of my life with a great companion. When I married in 1975, I was very willing, I was even eager to give up a college career for the role of wife and eventually mother. I pursued homemaking skills with a lot of vigor, and I felt a great sense of accomplishment in a job well done. And then the very unthinkable happened. The event that no active, young, obedient LDS family should ever experience. And that was the day that I gave birth to my fourth child. My companion was diagnosed with malignant melanoma. 8 months later, my very comfortable, righteous, normal life came to an end when my companion died. You know, initially I was buoyed up by feelings of confidence that surely God would replace what I had lost. Surely someone would come along and rescue me, and that I could return to my comfortable, nice, normal, righteous life. And eventually I realized that wasn't going to happen. So anger and depression became my principal character traits. I so badly wanted to relinquish my free agency to someone else so that I didn't have to make any kind of major decisions and be responsible for my actions. You know, it took a lot of time and a lot of patience and a lot of support from people who loved me and were close to me before I realized that all of my identity, all of my self-esteem had been wrapped up in my marriage and in my children. There really was another part inside of me that I'd never expressed that wanted to experience a wide variety of life's opportunities. First step I took was to convince my family dentist that I was really capable of learning to be his assistant. So I took that job, and I enjoyed answering patients' questions, and I enjoyed balancing the books. And I can tell you that very first paycheck I got, the elation and the satisfaction that I felt was absolutely indescribable. I wanted to frame it. I was so proud of myself. And I think it was maybe $100. My second big step was to go back to college after a 12-year absence. Now, I wanted to pursue a nursing career. And I have to tell you, my companion hated the nursing career. He was a physical therapist and worked quite closely with nurses. He felt like it was an absolutely wasted career, that all nurses were people who knew how to take orders from someone else, be at least 30 pounds overweight, and take a coffee break every 5 minutes. So in view of his attitude about nursing, I chose to let his attitude dissuade me during our marriage from ever pursuing a nursing career. Well, now that he was gone, I was going to prove him wrong. And I have to tell you, I have proved him wrong. I have learned that I have to give doctors orders sometimes. I'm only 15 pounds overweight. And I don't even have time to take a coffee. I don't even have time to go to the bathroom, much less go to lunch or take a coffee break. So I have proved him wrong. Anyway, back to the story. Fortunately, after a lot of very discouraging conversations with admission counselors at the colleges around here, I found one at the University of Utah who led me to believe that the only thing that was going to hold me back was my own personal fear. I left that woman's office determined that my widowhood and my long absence from college would not beat me, and that no matter what, I was going to finish college and I was going to get a bachelor's degree in nursing. Fortunately, I was able to let my children become a part of my quest. They'd come to classes with me. They'd sit outside the room while and play games and wait for the lecture to be done with. And they'd ask me each quarter when I'd register for class, they'd say, well, how many classes after this quarter till you're done? But I must confess, my brain was extremely slow to kick in. I felt like the cobwebs that had surrounded the intellectual lobe up there were so thick that it was going to take months to sweep them out, oil up the gears, fine-tune the machine, so that I could finally start absorbing my information. One of the biggest turning points came when I took chemistry. Chemistry is a prerequisite to the University of Utah's nursing program. You have to take a year of it. I hadn't had chemistry since the ninth grade, and I also discovered that one of the prerequisites to even start chemistry was to take algebra. I hadn't had algebra since the ninth grade. Now, I didn't have money and I didn't have time to take algebra. So I kind of slid into the class without my algebra course, and I prayed for a miracle. Unfortunately, that miracle came in the form of a dear, kind brother of mine who was a chemical engineer. He saw all my frustrations, all my tears, all the anxiety, and he volunteered to tutor me a couple times a week. I found the class so challenging that I also found my determination to get a college degree weakening, and I finally issued myself an ultimatum. I decided that if I wasn't going to get an A on the final, I was going to quit. So my brother dedicated more time to tutoring me, and I dedicated more time to studying. And the day after the final, I made a special trip up to the U to the teacher's office to find out what my score was, and it was an A. And it was at that point that the bonds of insecurity, depression, anger, and low self-esteem were broken. The happiness that I felt was indescribable. I wanted to stand on a rooftop and yell to everyone, "I did it. I won. I am not afraid to be a leader any longer." I realized then that nothing in life was beyond my reach. The only thing holding me back from doing things was my own personal motivation. I continued on in college and all the time wondering if this newfound freedom of mine was going to destroy me. It had given me a drive and a singular focus that became an absolute obsession with me. I would average about 4 hours of sleep a night. I had my children read my notes to me while I drove. I'd listen to tapes of the morning lecture that I'd sat through at night, and I carried my books with me to every single function I went to. But the day finally came, and I did graduate. All I could think about that day was, I did it. This is not the same person that I knew 4 years ago. I am so, so grateful to those people who supported me, and I'm so proud of the person that I have become. Free agency was my gift from God. I chose how to exercise it as a wife, and I chose how to exercise it as a widow. But I think as a widow, I've had the opportunity to realize what a precious gift that is. I can't turn over the responsibility of my actions to a spouse. I cannot hope that being married to the right person and hanging on to his coattails will absolve me from truly living up to my potential. But I do hope that being responsible for my own actions, choosing to allow others to help me, and developing my own identity will allow me to experience my God-given gift to the fullest extent, and that of being truly free.
When Gail asked me to do this and take over for our friend Nancy Lyon, I figured I was doing both Gail and my friend Nancy Lyon a favor. And then when I talked with her about what it was she wanted me to talk about, and she said, well, you're in the book and you speak about the idea that there are some people out there who don't have any trouble exercising their free agency, who just do what they want. And I thought about that, and I appreciated the fact that she said about me that she didn't consider me sort of a me, selfish person, because I don't like to think that that's the choice we have in life, that we have the choice to abdicate our agency and be generous and giving and helpful and kind, or we have the choice to indulge ourselves and be self-centered, egocentric, turn over to others the responsibilities for things that naturally fall in our domain or our bailiwick. And so as I was thinking about what I wanted to share with you in terms of concepts, I thought possibly the only difference between me and anybody else on this panel, or anybody else in the book, actually, is the fact that I seem to make my choices first and then find that dealing with the consequences or the reactions to my choices are where the struggles are. I have never had difficulty making choices or deciding what it was I wanted to do and go out and do it. I came from a very traditional family. I was raised here largely in Salt Lake. My mother never worked. My father's a doctor, and she was very active in all our lives. I'm the oldest of six children. She was very busy with primary and mutual at the time, the medical auxiliary wives, those kinds of things, PTA. But she was always home and very supportive of all the activities we were in. But I was raised, I think, with kind of the non-traditional attitude that whatever we as children wanted to do, we were encouraged to do, both by my mother and my father. And as little kids, if it was take gymnastics lessons, skating lessons, swimming lessons, tennis lessons, and I think I wanted to try every one of those. My poor parents, you know, let me flip from one thing, one activity to another, always with the encouragement that you can do whatever you want to do, Linda, as long as you do the work. And that was kind of the unsaid, unspoken, unwritten law. I was sharing with the primary students a couple of weeks ago, and I told this to Gail, the fact that we were asked to tell to the primary, a couple of us teachers, what lesson we had learned from our parents. And this was the lesson I was sharing, that I remember clearly never being told no except once. And that was when my sister and I, a sibling who's about 16 months younger, were prepared to jump off our house roof with an old army blanket of my father's to fly. And my dad did come out and say, most things, if you work hard enough at, you can accomplish. This one will never go. And I clearly think those kinds of things were the only times, those kinds of situations were the only times when my parents said, I think it best you not try. And otherwise, when I'd have ideas I wanted to teach all the neighbor kids a school in an abandoned truck, they'd say, here, go for it. And I'd work and work and get the homework lessons. And I was only 7 or 8. I was teaching school when I was in the primary grades. They just sort of sat back and watched. What they didn't do was the work for me. When I graduated from college, from the university, and decided that I wanted to go straight to San Francisco with sorority sisters and live, I know inside they were appalled at the idea. This was in the early 70s, and they were very concerned, but they said, you know what you need. You're going to need a job. You're going to need a place to stay. Do you have all those things worked out? No, but I will. Then good luck. They didn't do the work for me, but they seemed to always encourage me to go with my choices as long as I was willing to do the work. And I would say therein kind of lies the struggle that goes with agency. I don't have trouble making choices. Gail mentioned that I've always worked. I'll tell you a little bit about my situation. Our friends in our ward and neighborhood kind of chuckled about the references to me in the book, because it's pretty hard to miss, even though Gail used different names, because there aren't very many school teachers who have foreign husbands who travel or are always in some other country of the world, and so it was pretty easy for people to pick out who I was. I met my husband, who's from Rome, Italy, when I was living in San Francisco, and I'd never really intended to leave college and go there and make my life, but it was a choice. And I have found in reflecting that one choice quite clearly frequently leads to the next and to the next and to the next. And I think in terms of our agency, we have to be prepared to live with that attitude, that one choice made is going to eliminate other potential choices and require certain others. And I think we have to be comfortable with that way of life if we're really going to enjoy the free agency that we've been given. So when I moved to San Francisco thinking I was just going to work there with some sorority sisters for a while and then come home, I hadn't planned on meeting this crazy Italian who was there from Rome. And we married and stayed there. My two daughters were born there. I have two teenage daughters now. And it wasn't until 7 years ago that we actually came back to Utah. And during the previous years, I worked there. We moved abroad. We lived in Brussels for a couple of years and so on, all of which were choices that I made along the way. One choice I had made early in my life was I love teaching, and I would always plan on teaching. And I had always wanted children. It never seemed an incompatible idea that I could have children and keep teaching. And I did go to work when both my babies were small. I stayed out the obligatory time, the 6 to 9 weeks that the obstetrician required, and I was always back in class. And I taught until 4 days before I gave birth. Those were easy choices for me to make. But what I try and share with people in talking about something like that is the idea that I paid on the other end. I cried buckets and hours when I was interviewing, and I interviewed for my first baby, Sarah, 47 people for child care. And that's an incredible task, running around to people's homes, talking with them, meeting them, looking at the house, getting references. I'd go out in the car. My husband would drive me from one address to another. I'd get out in the car, and I'd cry, she's terrible, I can't leave the baby with her. And we'd go on to the next and so on. But it was my choice, and I felt like if I wanted to do what I wanted to do, I felt I had a certain talent as a teacher. I've always felt that the ability to affect other lives, I have taught for 20 years in very high-risk areas, San Francisco one for 15 years, and here in Salt Lake in some high-risk schools, I've always felt that the pleasure in affecting more lives than just my own two children has been really beneficial and has outweighed the trauma I faced in leaving my own children. I was very careful to find the right preschools. We were willing, and we made this decision together, to pay more money when we were in California when it was time for them to start school, to put them in a good private school rather than a public school that was would have been easier for me to drop them off in another place closer to where I worked and so on. But those kinds of struggles are the ones that naturally come with independence, I think. When our children were small, I decided I wanted to go back to graduate school. And my husband has always had the kinds of jobs that require travel. And initially it was largely around California and the western states, and then in the last 10 years or so it's been internationally. And so at that time I decided I want to go back to graduate school. I'm not going to give up my teaching job. He works a lot. He travels a lot. The decision was made. I'll go to school. I'll take classes at Berkeley, College of Notre Dame. Now, how do we do it once I've made the decision? Luckily, I have a husband who's very supportive, and he was able to finagle his schedule so that the nights I had to be in school from 7 to 10, he would be there with the girls because they were in school or preschool, those kinds of things during the day, so we wanted one parent there. And he's never had a struggle with doing those kinds of things. We've never had to argue about roles and responsibilities. He's home today while I'm here, tending my two nephews, who are 2 and 4, because I told my sister in California, sure, I'll be glad to tend your kids while you go to Hong Kong. It was a great choice, but they arrived yesterday morning, and I worked all day yesterday. My husband tended the boys, and he's got them again today, and my daughters are pitching in because I have other commitments, and they're very good about that kind of thing. I decided about a year and a half ago that along with teaching, I wanted to get a real estate license. I was thinking I might like to dabble with something else. And my family was very agreeable to considering pitching in so that I could teach all day and then go to my classes at night and get my license. And so I just sort of added another career this past year. And I teach in the morning. I'm an administrator at my school district in the afternoon. And I sell real estate besides. Now, that isn't easy. And one thing I will say about your free agency is that when you exercise it a lot, you have to be willing to work hard. Nancy made the comment with Gail and a group of us who were talking about this concept recently, saying that the reason it was so easy for me to be independent is because I have a husband who's never there. Do you remember that? And I don't agree. It's real hard, and I would not recommend the lifestyle that my husband Francesco and I and our daughters Sarah and Amanda have for everybody. But it's a choice that we have made, and we have decided long ago that it was something we were willing to work at. With him traveling, we have certain concessions. One is a mobile phone so that he can get me at any hour of the day, because he's always 8 to 15 hours difference in time than I am. One other thing we decided was that we wouldn't have 6, 8, 10 children. He came from a family as an only child, very little experience with children. I came from a lot. I had always thought as a child I wanted lots and lots of kids because I came from a big family. And as an adult, recognizing that I was working all the time, that I had a husband who frequently wasn't home, it probably wouldn't be the easiest thing for me to do or the fairest thing to my children to do to have 8 or 10, even though I like being with them. So I have become sort of surrogate parent to many, my mutual girls, my primary kids, all the students that I teach who ask me to be godmother or come to their weddings and their graduations. And I have made a choice that allows me to indulge that emotion, that wish, in other ways. My husband, when he isn't traveling, is usually home. That means when I'm out of the house working, if he's not on a plane or in a foreign country, he is actually in the house. He works a little in his office in the basement, sends a few faxes, makes phone calls and so on, and then he's there. And we have devised a system where we're real comfortable. He'll take the cleaning, he'll buy the groceries. He loves to shop. The man lives to shop. He loves to buy groceries. You can attest to that. And it's wonderful. He's a tremendous cook. I like to cook. He likes to cook. It's something we do together. we have made those kinds of trade-offs because, to allow for my independence. As far as the church goes, he's a convert to the church. And this was a risky choice I made. When I married him, he was not LDS. We had talked a lot about values, about attitudes toward family. He loved my family, which was very traditional, very active, and he seemed to really appreciate the values that he hadn't had growing up in Rome that his family doesn't have. I made the choice to marry him feeling that he would join the church, but I also said at the time, I made this commitment with myself, I would never try to force him to join the church. It would just never work. So I realized I was risking a lot on my own choice, but I did, and it was he who suggested, after we'd been married less than about 6 months, that he was ready to be baptized and wanted to have the missionary discussions. He does everything backwards. He said, I'm ready to be baptized. What do I have to do? And he did. But he initiated it. It was he who decided when we were in, interestingly enough, a Spanish-speaking ward in San Francisco, which was interesting for an Italian and somebody who didn't speak. I speak French and Italian, but no Spanish. And I was teaching the teacher development class at the time. He came home and said, I've signed us up for the temple classes. I was amazed that that was his choice. But it was after our first daughter had been born, and it seemed to be something he wanted to do. Now, he doesn't have the knowledge of the gospel that I think many of us who are born and raised in the church do. And every now and again, some real strange quirks creep into his attitudes when I hear him discuss things. And he has cultural biases that make him less typical an LDS man or priesthood holder than many would be. But it was a choice I made, and I have had to be willing to let him be who he is in order for me to be who I am. I'm tying this back to the idea that Nancy had said, it's easy for me when he's gone all the time. Well, it isn't easy. We made a decision that I would do the church service because he's rarely here, or because he's not continuously here on Sundays. He said, you can have all the church jobs. I'll just support you in them. You know, we did. He was the branch secretary when we lived in the mission field in Brussels for a while, and we did have an assignment as co-teachers of a Sunday school class, and all I really had was one extra 13-year-old boy in my class. So, you know, he had more fun than the other kids did. So... It's been interesting. It isn't without its difficulties. We have to work incredibly hard to spend time together. And Ginger was mentioning some of the kinds of the concerns that people mentioned to me. Aren't you worried your husband's going to stray? Aren't you worried he's gone so much that he'll be interested in someone else? Aren't you worried that you lose touch? We've addressed those. Those are choices I've made and he's made, and we've had to address those. We fight like crazy to spend time together. I pick him up frequently at the airport. I always take him and pick him up whenever he travels. And we don't get all the way home. We stop at the Marriott, or we stop at the Cotton Tree, only because we know we have to do that to get away from the... We have 4 phone lines and a fax in our house because of all the jobs and 2 teenage girls and so on. We have to plan that kind of thing. We just up and left town recently. I farmed out my 2 daughters at 16 and 17. They think they can stay alone, but I said... Will you take one? We're going to use our frequent flyer mileage, which we have, you know, millions of. And we went to New York for 4 days just so we could spend some time together. And that's hard. It's hard to work as hard as we have to make things good, but our 20th anniversary is this month. And so far, for us, it seems to work fine. It's not a choice I recommend to others. When people say to me, as someone did when I first moved back to Utah, oh, I'm so sorry you could only have 2 children... I say, I'm not the one who has the problem with agency, with being told what you have to do and what you don't have to do. That's an attitude, I think, that we force on one another sometimes. And so my concluding comment would be that I think I would encourage everyone, male and female, to exercise their agency, but to be willing to do what I think is a lot of extra hard work to back up that kind of independence. And it isn't easy.
Thank you. You were all just excellent. We have time, of course, now for questions. So if anyone has a question, I am supposed to speak the question into the mic. because they're taping this. So whatever you say, I will be repeating. And address, when you ask a question, please state who you are asking. And I hope you have some questions. Yes, over here. Okay, the question is to Ginger, and did Ginger, as she stopped controlling Jedmore, did he become more wonderful, and or did she become more wonderful?
I don't know about me, but certainly our relationship became more wonderful. Jed has always been interesting, and I don't think he never stopped doing what he wanted to in the first place. So you know, he continues to do all of the interesting things that he always did, but we don't fight about it anymore, and so I can enjoy some of those. I certainly feel more confident, and I feel like our relationship is a lot different from most of the relationships of my friends. I notice a lot of women who say things like, my husband won't let me do that. And when somebody says that, I think, well, what do you mean? Does he tie you up? Because to me, it's inconceivable that my husband wouldn't let me do something. He might not like it, but there's no question of allowing one of us to do another. So yeah, I guess we've both become more wonderful.
Yes.
I'm afraid that I... probably part of the problem that's always referred to, being a father and a priesthood holder and all of one of those controlling creatures. But I would like to ask your response to the question of whether women understand priesthood leadership principles. I wonder if it's not best to look at that concept as shared agency. If you look at Doctrine and Covenants 121, it says priesthood is only possible with love unfeigned and any degree of unrighteousness tying a woman up. It's amen to priesthood. So you can't tie somebody up with priesthood. And then in DNC 85, the principles of how priesthood leadership is to be exercised simply says to preside. Well, let's talk about it at 2 o'clock. And to sit in council with one another and teach one another the principles. Now, I hear a lot about I go my way, he goes his way, but if this principle of shared leadership, sitting in council with one another, were followed, might we have less concern about being held down and almost brutalized as the men are commonly? Do women teach men how to be leaders sometimes?
Okay. let's see. Do women teach men how to be leaders? Okay. I'm not exactly sure. You know, it was kind of a long question there, but maybe I'll just give some thoughts that I've had on the topic of priesthood and Mormon women. I think that I absolutely agree with what you said about priesthood being an instrument of service and so forth and so on. And that is how it is meant to be. I think where the problem comes in is that it looks like they're in charge and we're not. why? Because they're making all the decisions. They're not? Men in the church on all levels are the ones who are making most of the decisions. So as a woman, I have to ask myself, okay, do I really have my free agency when I'm not making the decisions? And my response is, of course I have my free agency. I don't have to do a darn thing anyone tells me to do, priesthood holding or not. But I think that... Well, I don't know. I forgot. I lost my train of thought. But I guess I agree with what you're saying, and I think in the church it would be wonderful if women had, you know, I don't know about the priesthood thing that, you know, who knows what will happen in 10 or 20 or 30 years, but I think that women would probably feel less frustrated or angry or whatever, if maybe they felt like that they had more of a voice, whether or not they held the priesthood. I don't know that that would really matter. But if women were sitting in more on the decision-making councils of the church at all levels, I think that they would have... a much greater sense of power about their lives and in the church, because right now all we can really say is, well, I don't have to do what they tell me to do. And that sounds really belligerent, and I don't, you know, my husband is in our bishopric, and so I think about these things a lot, and it's like, does he have power over me? Well, of course he doesn't. I mean, neither does the bishop. And, you know, my husband and I talk about this a lot. A leader, as we all know, is only as powerful as we allow them to be. And, you know, my husband gives the other side, which is, here we are at bishopric meeting, you know, for hours grinding this stuff out. You know, you think this is fun? You think? And then we call people in and we say, will you serve in the primary? No! Will you be the den leader? No! Will you do this? No, you know, if you really think about it, they really are there serving. They're there serving the ward, keeping things together, making decisions, all that sort of thing. And if we support them, then it all works and all runs properly. But of course, we don't have to. We have our free agency, whether or not we will. And so I don't have any resentment toward them. This is the way that the church is right now. But as I said earlier, I do think that it would behoove all of us, both men and women, if we did have more of a voice. Yeah.
My question is to Linda. I congratulate you on your lifestyle that I would not want. But I came from a large family of 12, and my mother's lifestyle was totally opposite of yours. And so you're from one end of the pendulum to what I've seen to the other. But my question to you is, and I'm trying to find a happy medium in between. My question to you is, how accessible are you and your husband both to your children in making this a family unit, which is what a lot of the basis of the church is all about?
That's a good question, and I think an appropriate one. I didn't address my children a lot, but a couple of weeks ago, 8 of us, Gail was one of them, were up at my cabin. We have a house kind of in the mountains, which is a getaway, and we were 8 women getting away overnight. And we were talking about this kind of thing, and we all have daughters, and I just have daughters, and we were speaking specifically about our daughters who are getting into the teenage years, and we were comparing curfews and how many nights they get to go out and drill team and pep club and all kinds of other dating and those kinds of things with one another. And this came up in the conversation, and I made the comment that about my children, we're saying how right now we all feel pretty good. We've really all got nice kids. They're successful. They do well in school. They have a lot of friends, good friends. We don't have to worry about their activities. They're wholesome. They're group-oriented. And I said, but we never know. I mean, I just kind of count my blessings. I say a grateful prayer every day that we got this far, that I got Sarah and Amanda this far. They've gotten themselves this far without any major problems. They've not done anything I'm not proud of. They seem to have strong testimonies. They seem to be kind and as unselfish as teenagers can be. They seem to be. They're impatient at times that I want things done faster, chores and so on, than they seem to do. They say, Mom, everybody doesn't have to be as busy as you are. Now, you ask, are they accessible? Are we accessible to them? I think the fact that we have only 2 makes it easier. I have lots of nieces and nephews, and one of the luxuries I afford myself is the opportunity to tend them and then give them back. I like to have a house full of kids when I don't have them, permanently. They're also at an age where their lives are very independent, and they are pursuing so many activities of their own that we do have to organize to meet together. It's required that we be there all for dinner because we can't always all be together for breakfast and for lunch. We're all in different places. When there's a problem, it's often the 3 girls My husband calls us that. You three girls. He's gone frequently, so it'll be the three of us lying on my bed or on the big couch downstairs or something, and we're talking about, well, what about this? What about that boy? What about, you know, these kinds of concerns? It takes work. I think we just have to do it a little differently, like we do many other things in our family, differently. I'm reminded of an incident. Several years ago, I was called into the bishop's office, and he was asking me if I would be the young women's president of the ward. And at the time, I thought, oh, my word. Why do you pick the person who works full-time, who's never there, you know, whose husband isn't there, and I have kids who are not yet in mutual. They were about a year away from being beehives. And the bishop then addressed this very next question. The bishop happened to be Gail's father-in-law, so this was an interesting situation because his next comment was, I'm calling you to this position, but I'm a little worried about the kids, about the girls. You know, what are you going to do with Sarah and Amanda when you have mutual activities, you know, one night a week, and Francesco isn't there to take them and so on? And he was asking me to do the job, number one, and at the same time asking me how on earth I was going to handle the problems, you know, that he'd already thought of. I hadn't even had time to think of yet. What am I going to do with my kids? So I thought quickly, and I said, well, Sarah is going to be a beehive in this coming year, and so she'll be there, and then Amanda follows the year after, and until then I'll ask friends to include them. You know, they're best friends. One best friend lives next door and one across the street, so it wasn't hard. But it occurred to me that this bishop, who was very traditional and very conservative, was asking me to be a role model for the young women of the ward. And I thought, it's pretty hard to camouflage the fact that I'm a pretty active woman, I have a full-time career or careers, that I'm trying to juggle home and family and children as well. And I'm going back to your question, sir, when you were talking about the priesthood. I think what we need is counsel from women to men so that decisions that are made about the way things go on in the church might indicate or reflect what's really happening in the wards out there. Because if bishops and stake presidents are calling us to still serve and act as role models in leadership positions in the ward, then it must be because we're doing a good job. And we're able to do a good job with our families and our husbands as well. Now, if my two girls turn out to be serial killers in 2 years, I take back everything I said, except I will not take full responsibility for their behavior. I think some of that is their choice, and that's the way it needs to be.
Yes. Do you want to speak into the mic? Okay. Okay. And I do always have a problem with giving permission. You know, we already have permission to do whatever we want, but I know it's just semantics. We beat each other up over semantics. But her question is for the tape recorder, what can we do? How can we change the church curriculum? Because clearly the message that she received, she's 47 years old, and that I received in my early 20s was that the only good Mormon woman was a woman who stayed at home. And Kim, would you like to answer that? Okay, because you haven't.
I was raised in the same era. And I'm glad you asked that, because that has been foremost in my mind for years and years because of my experience. I was raised all those years believing, you know, the good girl, the good LDS girls, marry the nice, handsome returned missionaries in the temple. And I love to tell people that once I did that, basically my responsibilities narrowed down to two things. Bake a good loaf of bread and look great in a teddy. And suddenly now, you know, you become the widow, and minimal higher education, no job skills that were marketable in my sense, and I was totally, totally unprepared for it. And on top of it, the insult, to me it was an insult, that God did not save me from this, that he didn't give me somebody to replace what I had lost so that I could return back to that traditional life. yes, I had done it right all these years, and how come I wasn't getting fixed? I was a good Mormon woman. How come God wasn't fixing it? I did everything right. And so as I have two of my children are girls, and I have got one that is 16 now, and what I have expressed numerous times to her as I have sat through the New Beginnings program with the mothers and daughters there and listened to all these glowing comments about marriage in the temple, having your education, raising your family, is that I would like to see the church emphasize more to the young women that it is more important for you, foremost in your mind, should be establishing your own self-esteem, feeling confident, feeling strong, exercising your free agency, and taking full responsibility for what you do, and becoming your own best friend. A marriage is icing on the cake. Children is simply an added blessing. But the fact remains that over 50% of the women in this church are single. The fact remains that at least 10% of LDS women are unable to ever conceive a child, either because of lack of opportunity or because of physical reasons. And I think that the curriculum is missing that. I think the curriculum is basically telling girls that the ultimate, the end all, the absolute pinnacle of your life is to marry and to have these children. And I would much rather see it emphasized that the ultimate, the pinnacle of your life is that you are a strong, productive, happy person, as opposed to the other end of it.
I wanted to address that for just a second. I would like to see, in terms of curriculum and the way we incorporate curriculum and attitudes in our wards and stakes, I would like to see two words really become paramount. The first word, especially in terms of curriculum, would be choice. I think if we could see about every other line and every other lesson the word choice, we would begin to encourage the second word, which is diversity. And I think for so long, I'm a product of the same education. I think we tout ourselves as a worldwide church. We convert members of great numbers of nationalities and cultural and ethnic backgrounds. We ought to encourage right here in Zion diversity in our wards, and I think that we'll go a long way to educate young men and young women if they start to see that the role models, the leaders, people in position of authority in the wards represent a wide variety of lifestyles and kinds of people, and yet they are still worthy to be in those positions of leadership. And I think we go a long way to teach that concept of choice. What we don't do well enough, I think, is validate that diversity among us. Now, I have two daughters, and people wonder if I am just bringing them up to be raving feminists, you know, that they've got, each of them must have 12 degrees and 9 careers. And I am not. I emphasize with them the concept of choice. They both want college educations. They both want some sort of a career preparation. She's gone from marine biology to journalism at the moment, but they change. But they both want children. One says she might be a teacher. They plan on husbands and families, etc. And I have just tried to encourage them choice. If their choices are to stay home and raise a family, then that title homemaker is just as valid as any of the others they've prepared for. But I think those two words, choice and diversity, we don't do enough with.
Yes. Okay, the question is, how has Ginger resolved... restate the question, Ginger.
How have I resolved the differences in our church activity, basically, is that right? Well, we certainly have fought about it a lot. I still, for a long time, I felt like I was right and he was wrong. And it was important to me, I think, to come to a conclusion that I'm not sure what's right for him. That was a really important attitude change for me to come to. He has a lot of difficulties and all kinds of feelings about church that have to do with a lot of experiences that are unconnected to me. We sort of have... He knows it's really important to me. Real critical or real negative about church, he knows we fight because I can't stand it. And so sometimes we choose not to discuss it if we feel like it's sensitive. In terms of just church attendance, you know, it's like, again, he doesn't try to control me. So he knows that I do my church jobs. I attend church as I want. And in terms of the children, partly I think I have a little bit of an advantage because we did marry in the temple. And so there were some basic assumptions that I can still sort of rely on, and that is that we raise the children in the church. And I just really try not to have the kids... I don't talk a lot about church with Jed and the kids. I talk to the kids about church, and he's careful not to criticize. In terms of Sunday, you know, I go and I handle a five-year-old and a three-year-old jumping all over the pews every Sunday myself, and when I sing in the choir... The kids scream wildly and up and down the halls, and it's really kind of awful. But it's better to go like that than to go to church and have him sitting like a stone brick next to me, hating everything. I much prefer to just separate it, and that's basically how we do it. Does that answer your question?
I'm from the old time. I'm 75. I'm from the time when your women weren't supposed to get educated. It's just their brothers. I had eight brothers. So I only got four quarters of college and went to work. I always wanted to go back to college. You know, I never got back there till I had daughters that had graduated from the university before I got back. I was raised in a traditional family. My mother always was home. I had eight younger brothers. She never worked. She never worked. What do you mean she never worked? She was president of the Relief Society, and we lived on a farm, and my dad traveled all the time. I was all ready to go back to school to Ann Arbor. I thought I was too old to go to University of Utah. I'd been out 6 years. Too old. So I was going back to Ann Arbor. And then I met my husband. And he says, well, you go back to school, but I'll be back to get you a Christmas. So he wasn't a Mormon. No way. And I married him. But he was raised not in a Mormon family. They were not Mormons, but his mother was, so never left that kitchen. She was home her whole life, and she lived to be 93 years old. She was married 75 years, and she always stayed in her kitchen. And that's what my husband thought I should do. But I didn't do it. He didn't join the church. I didn't try to make him. I've seen too many of these people that join the church and then they turn away. But I always sang. I was in the choir. And he used to stay home. That was good. He could tend the kids. I left him home to tend the kids. I said, do you want to go to church or do you want to tend the kids? Well, he stayed home and tended the kids. So I never had to, because I always sang in the choir. Always. We moved out to Holiday, and I decided no choir. Maybe if I stay home, if I don't sing in the choir, see, because you never get to sit with them. You have to be up in the choir. So then I moved to Holiday, and I never went in the choir. Well, it had been 18 years, and the missionaries, you know those state missionaries they send out? He'd worn out all of them. And they even came from time to time. He would not listen. He was friends. Oh, you don't know how good friends we had. And our children, but their babysitter, they always, you know, maybe had little kids. And so our daughter babysat their daughters. Our daughter taught dancing. She had a dancing school. So then all the missionaries' kids always took dancing from us. She was the seamstress, so she always sewed and did sewing things. But he joined the church. I'll tell you, once he joined the church, he was to church every minute. And then he was in the bishopric, he was in the high council, he was the bishop. And I wished I had one that would go away from home. The only time in my life that was wonderful was while he was bishop. That was 7 years. Do you know what I did? I went back to school. I did all the things. Of course, I'd gone back to school before to graduate, and I taught school for 12 years. But he wouldn't cooperate with me one bit because I was not supposed to be out teaching school. I was supposed to be home cooking and running, you know, a mother to be in the home. And it wasn't a Mormon idea because, see, he didn't join the church for, we were married 18 years before he joined the church. But anyway, I'm happy that we have these things going on now. But I wish the women would have a little bit more to say than what the men. They just want to, you know, we don't have any voice in anything of the church. Of course, yes, now we offer the prayers. But will they let me offer the prayer? Do you know why? Because I bless our mother in heaven. I don't know. I go to all these sessions. I've gone to the Sunstone since it began. But I feel like we need to get a woman's input, just like these say. And even if this young generation, and they are working, and all mothers are working and being away from home, but they're raising good kids. They're raising real good kids. But then why do we just have to be dictated every move we make? I was talking about...
Ma'am, do you have a question?
No, I just wanted to give a... I just wanted to give a little insight to all the things that you up here have been talking about.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions? Yeah. How? Okay. Okay. I think if I got her question correctly, it's how can you be a feminist within the church? And first of all, I have to say, just really quick, that in my book jacket it says that Gail Newbold has accomplished this nearly impossible task. She speaks boldly and candidly without being feminist. Without being feminist. Anti-church, anti-male, anti-priest. So whenever I do in-person lectures, I always say, I am a feminist. But that's so they could sell more books, you know. But that's because I'm like you, and your conversation with your mother, I don't consider being a feminist a dirty word anymore. And to me, being a feminist is just being pro-woman. And abortion and ERA and stuff, so how to be a feminist in the church. I think, you know, I talk about this, and to me, it's really important that we keep working on making changes in the church in a positive and constructive way. I personally would not want to chain myself to the temple gates or something. But on the other hand, sometimes you wonder if it's not the really angry, volatile people who have caused changes to come about. But my personal feeling is that doesn't make me feel very good inside, that I am a letter writer. I noticed that in the church news, whenever they announced the mission presidents, their wives, all they would ever say about their wives is number of children. And so I called the church news and I said, why is this the case? And the editor
you could tell he was kind of, who's this lady and why is she asking me this? But he was really nice, and he said, well, the fact of the matter is we just write up these stories from these forms that we get from the church missionary department. The forms do not ask the women. There is no line on the form asking women what her accomplishments are other than number of children and marital status. So next, I wrote a letter to the church missionary department, and I will say, I'll be perfectly honest, I was afraid. That's how I've been raised, is you just accept things, you know? And I had visions of Sonia Johnson came into my mind. They're going to get this letter, and they're going to excommunicate me. You know, I was afraid. I hate to admit that, but I was. You know, I put that letter in the mail. And it was a nice letter. It was a real nice letter, and it just, my in-laws were mission presidents in Australia at the time. I hate saying mission president and wife. They both have an equal calling, I'm telling you. It is so much work and sacrifice for both. I think it should be mission presidency or something. But anyway, so I wrote the mission department a letter and said, I know I have noticed that this is the case. I know there are a lot of women like my mother-in-law that probably could care less if you say anything about her, but it's important to me. Why don't you have this? And I'm not claiming that it's because of me, but I have noticed now that in the church news, they do, when there is something to be said, they do say it about women. They now will say her educational accomplishments, whether she has a job and that type of thing. So I really do think there are things we can do. And then just the little example that I give in my book about, how in the church the bishop will come up. You know, I had a friend who's a graduate student who's been on a mission, you know, and the bishop came up to her and her husband when they were new in the ward and said, well, Dave, we'd like you to give a doctrinal talk, and Maria, we want you to introduce the family. You know, and so my friend Maria, this is Stephen Covey's daughter, she's a wonderful, wonderful, sweet woman. She's not going to rip into the bishop and say, well, you know, she simply gave a doctrinal talk. And so I really think that there are many things that we can do constructively, and I think that meanwhile, while we wait for things to change, each of us really has to be careful, like what you were saying. We really have to fight, I find sometimes, fight the urge to be overly critical and overly negative, because otherwise, what's the point in staying? I have to sometimes remind myself of the reasons I'm here, because I love it, because it means a lot to me. I want the church for my children. I want it for myself. I really do love religion. The reasons go on and on why I'm here. And I can get admired and enmeshed in some of the, you know, the feminist things, and then being a part of church becomes counterproductive. We have like 2 minutes.
The thing that I would like to say to the panel briefly. Yes, the thing that I'd like to express appreciation of the panel for this morning is for having reminded me, if not you, that the Holy of Holies is not in a building, but is at the essence of the human soul. And I find all four of these women very embraceable, because in my own opinion, I think one of the most embraceable things on God's earth is a human being committed to the affirmation of the life that is our own.
Thank you very much. That was an excellent conclusion. We'll end there. Thank you for coming.